welcome to this week's serving of Oyster Stew, a mix of financial services commentary and insight. Each week, we'll discuss what is happening in the industry based on what we see as we work with regulators and clients. We hope you come away with the knowledge and tools to help you make the best decisions for your firm's future. You can learn more about Oyster Consulting and the value we can add to your firm by going to our website, www.oysterllc.com.
Welcome to our latest episode of Oyster Stew, and this week we are on our fourth Reg BI podcast, and today I think our focus is the disclosure obligation. Is that right?
I think that's right, Polly.
Thanks, Nikki. My name is Polly Quartle. I am a managing director here at Oyster, and I am joined by Nikki Brinkerhoff, one of our associate directors, and Lance Whittemore, one of our senior consultants. Now, as I understand it, and you guys will probably correct me because I'm probably wrong, but most firms will include their disclosures in the new form CRS. Is that correct?
That's right, Polly.
All right, so I'm doing pretty good so far. All right, Lance, I know you work with a lot of investment advisory firms, and they have their ADV brochures. Is this going to be similar to an ADV brochure? Anything kind of the same between the form and the brochure?
Yeah, Polly. For investment advisors who are already a pure fiduciary, this is certainly a more straightforward process than it is for the broker-dealer community. If firms like that have stayed current on their conflict inventories and kept their compliance manual and Form ADV-2 updated to reflect the business practices they're in, and if they've reviewed their advisory agreements to ensure that they include all the ways that they earn fees in a relationship, then they've got a really good start on finishing this process. It's just different enough, though, so that it is a helpful exercise for an overall compliance program. It's always a good way to examine your own practices and consider how you want to disclose those and if they're disclosed, and a good way to put those practices in context against your overall client relationship.
All right. Well, Nikki, we know, like Lance said, this rule isn't just about advisory firms. It's about all kinds of firms. So are there differences across the different kinds of firms about how they'll have to do their disclosures and what types of disclosures they should include?
Well, Polly, I think for all firms, it's different because every firm has a different compensation structure, has different product partners, has internal partners versus external partners. So like Lance said, being able to conduct an analysis, understand where and how your business works, and then properly disclose it is going to be different for every firm. A hybrid firm that does nothing but retail customers is going to have a whole different looking disclosure than an institutional firm that does retail customers as an accommodation. So each one of those firms, between the inventory of their disclosures, like Lance said, and conducting that gap analysis, is going to be a different exercise for both.
So Lance, give me one or two of the top things you think every firm should really have on their minds when they go about doing these disclosures. It seems like it could be a big task to take on, to think about all of the things that you should include in your disclosure. So give me just a couple things that can get them started and get them going in the right direction.
Certainly. I mean, I think Nikki really made a very good point when she said that some larger and hybrid firms and broker-dealer firms with multiple lines of business can think of this as a very daunting task. One place to start is with a firm's general ledger. Any source of income is obviously going to be a potential conflict to be disclosed. Taking that approach and starting by listing all the ways that a firm generates its own income can serve to demystify the process and maybe give you a place to start. I mean, certainly there are conflicts that don't necessarily earn fees. There are practices that are just intrinsic conflicts that may not show up on the balance sheet, but that's one place to look at if you're having a hard time getting going.
Okay, and what else should they be thinking about?
Lance, I think you're right in the taking your balance sheet, but you also have to look at incentives and trips and, you know, if you get a discount or soft dollars by the volume you do with somebody. Those are all pieces, don't you think, that have to go into the thought process?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I also think that other things that you can maybe make revenue neutral, but still have some sort of an unmeasurable influence on the way that you do your business also count. For example, you know, larger firms that may have an affiliated fund that they manage themselves and might want to use that in some of their client accounts. I mean, even if you're rebating your management fees from a self-managed fund to a client, you still have some intrinsic incentives to use that fund just to make it bigger. So those are the kind of things you want to look at.
I think the point is start with your GL and then identify what makes your GL bigger or potential to make your GL bigger. Does that sound right, Lance?
Absolutely. And I think other things like maybe a self-managed fund or that sort of thing, which can give you a larger space in the marketplace of ideas or something that can promote your name out there and make you a bigger player in the overall marketplace. Those are also things that have non-financial incentives that you want to consider when you think about disclosing conflicts of interest and measuring those, you know, for the sake of Form CRS and for investment advisors, also for your Form ADV Part 2A.
So, Polly, I think Lance brings up a really good point, which is if you don't do a thorough gap analysis, identify all the things you have in that inventory, you can't disclose them. So start with the first step and then move out and map out how you'll be able to either mitigate or disclose, or actually some cases you could eliminate those conflicts.
Yeah, and that first step being that inventory of conflicts, you mean?
Yeah, I think you have to have that, like Lance said, to start with.
And I thought, Lance, your point about the mutual fund, having an internal mutual fund, and even if you rebate the fees, the growth of that mutual fund itself could be a conflict even though you're not receiving direct revenue from it. That's a very interesting point that I'm not sure many people would consider. So I think that's also an interesting point. It seems like the disclosures could get huge. And I think, if I understand correctly, there is some limit to the length of the form. Is that correct?
Yes. For pure investment advisors, I believe it's 2 pages. And there are even limits to the size of type you can use. They must be at least 8 or 10 point type, I think. And you're not allowed to make it any longer than that. And there's also the requirement that it be plain English. Nikki can correct me, but I believe that for broker dealers and hybrids, you have a little more room to work with. But yeah, you're under a lot of pressure to make this very succinct and clear at the same time.
Yeah, so that in and of itself could be a challenge, just getting it down to the 2 pages or 3 or 4 pages, if that's what the requirement is on the BD side. And that seems like that could be a challenge for firms. And it almost like lands on the advisory side. Would you describe it as kind of a summary of the ADV brochure at that point?
I wouldn't exactly call it a summary, but it certainly should rhyme. They should be consistent. I think it's also interesting to note too that in the SEC's release about the standards of conduct for investment advisors, you know, they don't just limit disclosure to Form CRS. In fact, they're pretty consistent in returning to the concept of informed consent as being a key component of fiduciary duty. And they talk about how informed consent can not just come in the ADV Part 2A brochure, although they do mention that. They also specify that the language and the framework of the investment advisory agreement can also shape your relationship. And when they talk about informed consent, they seem to really key in on the advisory agreement as one of the places that can happen. And it seems that they expect your advisory agreement and your ADV Part 2A to act in conjunction to shape the relationship with a client.
Interesting. And then, of course, that presents the risk later on for firms that all of them get out of sync.
That is true, and that's why it's important to review both your ADV Part 2A and your advisory agreement fairly frequently and make sure that they agree with one another and also that they're consistent with, you know, your actual practices and your manual.
All right, so that tells us a little bit about the advisory firm. Nikki, can you tell us a little bit about the length for the broker-dealers or hybrid firms?
Sure. For the investment advisors, they're limited to 2 pages, like Lance said. And for dual registrants, they'll be limited to 4 pages. So investment advisors, broker-dealers, 2 pages for the summary, and dual registrants are limited to 4 pages or the equivalent of 4 pages in an electronic format.
Okay. So they get a little bit more space to deal with. So I know in our third podcast on the topic, we talked about the conflict inventory a great deal. And so if you have this huge conflict inventory, are you going to end up disclosing every one of those conflicts?
Well, I think you can eliminate some. So your first and easy pass is what can you eliminate? But then I think there's things you can't eliminate, and you have to find a way to disclose it. Lance, what do you think?
Well, I think that's especially important on the investment advisor side. Going back to the standards of conduct for IAs that were released back in June, those specify that the advisor may shape the relationship by agreement, provided that there's full and fair disclosure and informed consent. So what that means is that if there are any conflicts that you can't or won't mitigate, it becomes increasingly important to ensure that those get specified in your agreement and in your ADV Form 2A. So, for example, going back to what I was talking about earlier about an affiliate-managed mutual fund, if you're going to use that inside your own client's advisory accounts, you know, obviously that presents a great conflict of interest. But if you can specify that inside the advisory agreement to such a degree that it is part of your relationship, if it shapes the relationship, as they said, then you don't need to mitigate that and you don't need to eliminate it.
So, Polly, I think Lance is right. It's all about informed investors being able to make a decision based on what the business looks like and who they're doing business with. And it comes back to clear English and providing them the information, and they can decide to have a relationship with an advisor or a BD based on what their current structure looks like.
Okay, and it looks like FINRA just a couple days ago came out with some additional guidance around Reg BI, and they've got a page dedicated to Reg BI and a pretty pretty big checklist around the form CRS. So looks like they're coming up with some resources for firms now. And I know the SEC has published that piece. When did you say that came out, Lance? Was that in June?
It was in June. It was part of the package of the original Reg BI releases. It was about a 45-page segment where they formalized the standards of conduct for investment advisors. And this is the piece that people described as a further clarification of the definition of fiduciary duty.
So we are getting ready. So we're getting some resources now from the regulators, which will help firms out. But I think it's still a pretty daunting task, especially the conflict inventory and figuring out what you can mitigate, what you can eliminate. And of course, we at Oyster Consulting are always happy to help our clients. We have a number of ways that we can do that with all four of the obligations under Reg BI, and we're happy to do that. We hope that everyone has gotten something out of this podcast. Lance, any last comments before we kind of close up?
I think one last thought on this is that generally with big rulemaking packages like this, you tend to see some frequently asked question releases as they get closer to implementation. So, you know, definitely be on the lookout for FAQs for further guidance that may narrow down the focus on some of these questions that still seem pretty vague. And the other thing I'd say is that even though I make it sound like the investment advisor side is simpler than the broker-dealer side, it's certainly no less important. It may be less complicated to have a pure investment advisor business, but you definitely want to be as accurate as you can in what you say and do.
Absolutely. And Nikki, any last thoughts from you before we finish up here?
I agree with Lance. There'll be a lot of guidance that comes out, but firms should start now. if they don't understand what they have that they're going to have to address or disclose, they can't easily apply the additional guidance as it comes time to comply, and it's going to become time to comply before we know it.
Yes, absolutely. It seems far away, but it's actually not that far away, and you'd rather be prepared and just tweak what you have than get to that point and have waited for the guidance and not be prepared at all. So again, everybody, thanks for listening to the podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. We've got, I think, one more podcast coming out on RegBI. I think there are 5 in the series. If you want more information about Oyster Consulting, you can visit us at oysterllc.com. That's OYSTERLLC.com, and learn about our services and our consultants. You can learn more about Lance and Nikki on our site, on the About page under Consultants. And we hope you got something out of the podcast. We hope you'll be listening for future podcasts. And thanks, everybody.